You're listening to the ISF podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve speaks with Lauren Farina, psychotherapist and founder of Invited Psychotherapy and Coaching. Lauren and Steve discuss how wellness is becoming a bigger part of the workplace and how we can stay mentally healthy during times of stress and pressure. Also an expert on high-performance individuals, Lauren shares what it means to be high-performing and why rest can be just as productive as work.
So Lauren, it's lovely to have you with me here on the podcast today. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're a licensed psychotherapist and a certified coach, and you've been operating in these areas for almost two decades now, specifically looking at things like high performance, motivation in the workplace. I want to get into those, but first of all, what are some of the changes that you've seen in the workplace over that sort of almost two decade period? Because context, for me anyway, does tend to impact the way in which people react, right?
Absolutely. And there have been so many changes from the shift to remote working to, I think, an increased emphasis on emotional well-being and the intersectionality between well-being and performance. And that's sort of where I come in. I know when I first started to work with this population of high-performing professionals, well-being and mental health were still taboo. People didn't really feel comfortable talking about this in the workplace. And now I'd say it's very much more commonplace. And I think leaders are really embracing the research that supports performance as a byproduct of well-being. And so those are some of the shifts. Of course, there's been a shift to a more digital workforce. We're working to embrace AI, et cetera. But as far as I'm concerned, and what's been most relevant to my work, I think it's the increased focus on an appreciation for wellness.
And that's something I think that, certainly if I think about myself, I became very aware of that during the COVID era, because it was all about trying to get that balance, wasn't it? Because I think in the beginning, people felt that they had to spend very much more time online, digitally communicating, reaching out to people, often, I think, to the detriment of what they were probably trying to achieve. I think the wellness piece came into really sharp focus, for me anyway, at that point. But if I'm being honest, I suppose post-COVID, I've almost tended to forget some of that and slip back into those old ways, particularly, I would say, in the current market climate, where everything is just so volatile that you become a little bit overly focused on trying to put more effort in, which actually means you're probably getting less out.
Absolutely. And I think that's the paradox that really interests me and that I've honed in on in this work, is this narrative that I think many of us have, that the harder I work and the harder I am on myself, the better I'll perform. And I think that can often be true in the short term. As many of us know, acute stress is quite good for us. Mm. But in the long term, the chronic unrelenting demands that I think remote working arrangements have placed on the workforce really can erode our performance, because our cognitive functioning is not at its peak when we're chronically stressed. Our memory, our learning, our judgment, our decision making is compromised. Mm-hmm. And so to your point, yeah, I think we get less done sometimes, the less boundary we are about well-being.
So what are some of the things that people can do then to, first of all, I guess, spot that, and then secondly, do something about it?
Yeah, I think number one, awareness. And it might sound so cliche, but to recognize when we have some disturbance. I often say that symptoms are messengers, right? And so if we're feeling fatigued or burnt out or irritable or brain fog, that's our system speaking to us, letting us know that something is amiss, that there is some imbalance or unmet need that requires our attention, right? So what I found is that high performers are often so attuned to and connected to the outside world and the expectations of the people around us that as a result, we tend to tune out from our inner world and our own thoughts and feelings and needs. And so often my very first step with coaching and therapy clients is awareness, tuning in. What is it that you're thinking and feeling? And sometimes that in of itself can be revealing, right? The second question that I encourage people to ask is there an inner guidance that I am withholding from expression or even consideration? because my clients are sharp. Many of them know what it is that they need. And so it could be, yeah, I know I need to get more rest, or I need to have this conversation with my boss mm-hmm. or with my partner. And so really sometimes the work is about clearing away the debris that can cloud those answers, right? And fear can cloud those answers.
I suppose before we go any further, Lauren, it'd be worth us trying to define what a high performer is, because I suspect that people listening to this will all have different ideas of what that might look like.
Steve, I think that's such a good question, because in my experience, the high performer is not just limited to the high performing professional.
Right.
I see a lot of those, but my definition of a high performer is anyone who diligently performs a role, a character, or a function, often at the expense of their own needs.
Right.
So I've worked with a lot of high performing parents, right? High performing students.
Right.
And I think it's that at the expense of their own needs piece that really requires our attention and consideration.
Now, you've also, I understand, defined something called the sort of the high performer archetype. Tell us a little bit about that, because I was really interested in that when I was doing some of the research before this.
Yeah, so the high performer archetype is a cluster of personality traits that are commonplace among high performing personalities, and they include perfectionism. So perfectionism meaning the tendency to set perhaps unreasonably high expectations for ourselves as a rule. People pleasing, which is the need to appease and accommodate others, often at the expense, again, of our own needs. And then codependency. And I see a lot of codependency, which is the need to be needed or the need to be helpful. And again, the tendency to take responsibility for people and things that just aren't ours. And these traits, what I want to emphasize, Steve, is these traits aren't bad or wrong.
Right.
I think these days perfectionism gets a bad rap. Mm-hmm. But perfectionism and people-pleasing and even codependency in some respect can help us to be motivated, can compel ambition and productivity and nurture our relationships. But I would argue that we should be conscious and, again, aware of the ways in which those traits serve us and the things that they cost us mm-hmm. as well.
That's an interesting way of putting it. So what you're saying, I guess, is that it's about balance, right?
Exactly. And that there's duality in sort of all things, but especially the high performer archetype.
So I'm guessing now that some of the high performers that you work with will come to you because they've recognized, yes, they are performing at the top of their game. And some of them, I'll probably include myself in this, will get frustrated if that sort of drops off a little bit. I spent a lot of time working with sports psychologists a number of years ago. And one of the things that they really tried to get through to me was, if I was a top performing athlete, for instance, because they used to work at the Olympics, it's unrealistic to expect yourself to be constantly performing at the peak. And what you're trying to do is to make sure that you actually crest to the peak of your capability at the right time. And so putting that back into a business context, what are some of the things that people who either aspire to be high performers or indeed are high performers, what are some of the things that they might be able to do to build to that sort of crescendo, if you like, and avoid expecting themselves always to be performing at this peak, which is totally unrealistic?
Exactly. And I'd like to reference the research of Brad Stolberg and Steve Magnus. I don't know if you're familiar with their work, but they're researchers in the field of performance and motivation. They co-authored a book called Peak Performance. And what they've done is they've studied peak performers in all different arenas, business, sports, medicine, et cetera. And then they boiled down the common denominators in terms of their peak performance habits and cross-referenced those findings with their own research. Mm-hmm. And so what Stolberg and Magnus talk a lot about is something that they term stress-rest cycling,
right?
Which means that we must cycle in periods of intense, in total rest following periods of acute stress, which is antithetical, I think, to the way, to your point, Steve, that many peak performers operate and approach goal achievement. Mm-hmm. And so what I often say to my clients is, if you decide that you wanted to build your bicep muscle, and so you picked up a barbell and you said, well, I'm a peak performer and I'm going to work until I achieve my goal. So I'm going to start doing curls and I'm never going to stop until I get there. We would exhaust ourselves, right? I mean, we would just totally burn out and probably cause even more damage to that muscle would certainly cause more damage to that muscle. So really honing in on when is it appropriate to work and to stress, and how can we cycle in periods of intense rest, not as a luxury, but as productive downtime, because downtime is productive. The other thing that I'll share, and this is also in alignment with Stolberg and Magnas, and what they found is, I think values alignment is so critical to not only our well-being, but also our heights of success. Because we know that when we're living in alignment with our values, when we're working towards a purpose or a mission that we feel passionate about, we're more likely to sustain motivation and drive and focus and energy versus when we're working towards something that might be extrinsically motivated. Right. Somebody tells us we should care about this goal, or our boss wants us to work on this project that isn't really motivating or energizing. So building intrinsic motivation through values alignment and remembering to cycle in rest after stress, I think are key.
Now, I'm thinking of specifically about some of the security professionals who listen in to this podcast. Describe for me, if you would, what happens to a high performer who doesn't build in that rest process?
Steve, our nervous system, our mind and our body work in concert to detect cues of safety versus danger. Okay. So our nervous system is always scanning, you know, on the subject of security, always scanning for cues of safety versus danger. And our nervous system does not know the difference between physical stress and mental stress. So I open my inbox and I've got 100 unopened messages. Our nervous system can't distinguish between that and a clear and present danger. Our nervous system also cannot distinguish between a real threat and an imagined one, right? So if I imagine something going left at work, it's as if I'm experiencing it in real time. So when we don't give ourselves an opportunity for rest, our nervous system interprets this as a challenge, a stress, or a threat. It's a cue of danger, and it activates the fight or flight response, otherwise known as sympathetic dominance. When we're in fight or flight, this is an evolutionary response that developed among ancient humans in an effort to protect us from what the danger was that ancient humans faced. So either an attack by an enemy tribe or an animal predator. And so what the system does is it allocates resources away from what it considers non-vital functions. Mm-hmm. So cognitive functioning is considered a non-vital function.
Right.
Digestion, for example, hormonal balance, immune system regulation, those are all considered non-vital functions because they're not necessary in order to escape danger.
Right.
So over time, if we fail to send our nervous system cues of safety through rest and downtime in connection with the people that we care about, we become chronically stuck in fight or flight. That's why when people experience symptoms of burnout, and we're very vulnerable to burnout in the absence of rest mm-hmm. on a long-term basis, we might experience a lack of focus, poor learning, poor memory, poor recall, impaired judgment, impaired decision-making, in addition to a whole host of physical symptoms that are the byproduct of the chronic stress response activation. Right. And so this is one of my favorite conversations to have with peak performers who really struggle with rest. And so my argument is often that rest is not just rest. It is that productive downtime that I referenced earlier, because in rest, you are supporting your system's ability to function optimally, cognitively and otherwise.
Because, of course, from the security standpoint, what really we want people to be able to do is to respond in the moment to a breach, an attack or something like that. And you never know when it's coming. So you have to be at your peak in a measured way, which means that you've got to take time out, right?
And I would argue that in that setting, what you're talking about is some level of alertness mm-hmm. and hypervigilance, which is required when working in security. But I would argue even more, the demands of that kind of work require even more attention to rest
right.
than I would say somebody working in a different field or in a different profession. I work with a lot of physicians mm-hmm. who work in the ICU or in the emergency room on call. And so they have to be alert to and attentive to what might happen at a moment's notice. And that can be taxing on the nervous system. So when they're not working in that way, when they have carved out periods of rest, the system can recover. And I would argue it's imperative that it does to allow for that alertness and that focus.
What does a reasonable amount of rest look like? Because back in the old days, you'd go into work, maybe you'd do a 9 till 5, you get some time on the train, on the way in, on the way out, and you'd go to bed at, I don't know what, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, something like that, whatever it was. So it was all nicely boxed up for people. Today, of course, we don't work like that. So what does a good amount of rest and recuperation look like?
I think it's highly individual. I once had a surgeon say, my work-life balance is at work. That's how I find balance, is in the operating room. And I thought, who am I to challenge that? But in general, and I know that it might sound cliche, but the 7 to 9 hours of sleep are really important. And the 7 to 9 hours of restorative sleep are so important because that's when we consolidate information. That's when the body detoxifies itself, especially the brain. And so if we can, at the very least, protect our sleep and protect our sleep environment, because I think another way that the workplace is changing, Steve, is there's an increased emphasis on biohacking. And my hope is that is because companies are recognizing the effect of physical health on mental health and therefore performance. And so if we're talking about sleep, I also want to bring the attention of your audience to the other sort of stressors that we face in our physical environment in 2025. We are on our devices a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And blue light can be stressful, is stressful to the brain. And so I would really encourage your listeners to think about not only setting boundaries around work when appropriate and when possible, but also setting boundaries around how often am I on a device and can I allow my body physical rest in addition to mental rest. So those are the very first two things I assess for in my clients is how are you sleeping? Mm-hmm. Because without sleep, we cannot function optimally. We can't even dream to function optimally. And how much time are you spending online? Because believe it or not, that does have a big effect on our system's experience of stress and its ability to rest.
And what about things like diet and exercise? What roles do they play?
Huge. And again, I know that it sounds cliche, but there's so much cutting edge research that's surfacing now around the metabolic roots of all brain disease. Dr. Chris Palmer is a Harvard professor of psychiatry. He's a practicing psychiatrist, and he's published, I think, a really revolutionary book entitled Brain Energy. And he posits in that book that all brain disease and dysfunction, not just mental illness, but also cognitive decline, Alzheimer's, dementia, even autism spectrum disorders, ADHD, are rooted in some level of metabolic dysfunction. In other words, if our cells can't efficiently and effectively metabolize energy, then our organs and especially our brain can't access the energy that it needs in order to perform at its peak.
Right.
And so really paying attention to eating a diet of whole foods, nutrient-dense foods, and just getting the body moving can be so supportive, not only to physical health, but also to metabolic health and therefore mental health and cognitive functioning. And so that is something that I really encourage my clients to consider.
Okay, so we've been talking about the individual. I'd like to just shift it a little bit now to the team, high-performing teams, because there's very little that we do, I think certainly in the security space anyway, where it's all down to one individual contributor. Security is a team game. So what we're trying to do is to get the best performance from our teams. How can the manager, the leader of a particular team, what are some of the things that he or she can do, perhaps is a better question, to really help the team perform at peak?
Steve, there was a 5-year study at Google called the Aristotle Project. And the Aristotle Project found that psychological safety is the single most important factor when it comes to the elite performance of individuals and groups. And psychological safety really just refers to a culture of openness and respect and trust. And trust can be hard to operationalize, but if leaders are thinking about how they can support their teams in optimizing performance, they need to be thinking about how they are fostering trust. And some of the ingredients, if you will, to an environment of trust and psychological safety include boundary setting,
right,
open and honest communication to the extent that it's possible. We can't share everything with our employees, but if we can be open and honest enough, that really goes a long way to beget trust.
Right.
Generosity of interpretation, right? So when people do make mistakes and admit to their mistakes, we assume good intention. Fostering an environment of non-judgment, which does not mean an environment absent of pressure or expectation or even accountability, but really an environment of emotional non-judgment, that people don't need to fear retaliation if they share an idea or ask a question or ask for help or admit to not knowing something. Mm-hmm. Because in a psychologically unsafe environment, people are unwilling to do those things, to ask for help, to admit when they don't know something, to acknowledge an error, or to share a new idea. And the open and honest exchange of information and ideas, especially in 2025, is crucial to the success of a group and an organization.
So what I'm hearing you say is that there is both individual responsibility here and collective.
Yes.
So if a team feels that it isn't getting some of those things you've just outlined, there's nothing wrong in an open and transparent way for them to be asking for it or to be actually raising that as an issue collectively amongst themselves and brainstorming how that might be solved. Would that be fair?
Absolutely. And we call this constructive conflict.
Right.
And a lot of high performing teams will actually create what's called a challenge network, mm-hmm, right? In which they invite individuals who are known to maybe rock the boat,
right,
or speak up, or who aren't afraid to ruffle a few feathers in a very respective and professional way, to be able to generate ideas and come to the table to problem solve. And so in a psychologically unsafe environment, that is not possible. Constructive conflict is not possible. And instead, people tend to censor themselves. And so I think what leaders should be thinking about is how to foster trust and therefore psychological safety, which does not imply coziness or coddling. It's actually the exact opposite, in which people are free to openly exchange information and ideas.
Fascinating. And I'm sure people will be sitting there thinking about their own teams, their own situations, and do I fit into this category or that category? How might I change it? But before we come to a close on this, Lauren, because it's been fascinating going into some of these things, how do you see the workplace changing? Because you've talked about some of these real challenges, perhaps, and how we might overcome them, looking at the world through that high-performance lens. But we also made the point that the workplace is changing very significantly. How do you see things evolving and what might be the impact on people over, say, the next 5 to 10 years? Big question, I know, but.
Yeah, I think some of the things that we touched on a little bit earlier. So perhaps it is my hope, at least, that there will be an increased focus on the intersectionality of performance and well-being and increased support of individuals and groups in cultivating well-being, mm-hmm, not only for the sake of well-being, but also for the sake of peak performance. I think, to your point, Steve, we'll also have to be more intentional around navigating the remote working space. Right. So what does that mean in terms of the elusive work-life balance? Mm-hmm. What does that mean in terms of our ability to set boundaries,
right,
and take time to rest and to connect with our families, et cetera? I think we'll also see a continued rise of shared working spaces. So what does that mean for teams and connection? We'll have to be really thoughtful and intentional about maintaining a team mentality in connection with not only our colleagues and our groups, but also our mission at work, because I worry that might be eroded when each individual is sitting and working out of their basement, right? And then I also think leaders, we touched on AI a little bit. I know that you've talked about that in previous episodes, but I think leaders will have to think about how they can best support and encourage their employees to embrace AI, mm-hmm, and to value technology, and to continue to use AI tools in the workplace versus fear them. So those are just a few ideas, but the workplace has changed so dramatically in even the past 5 years. I think we're about to see even more rapid change in the next 10.
Lauren, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Some really good insights there that I hope people will take away, both at the individual level and also at the team level. And I think, you know, that whole piece about balance, we so often talk about work-life balance, but actually for me, it's more about the individual understanding how they can achieve balance themselves.
That's right. And that's why I'm really careful not to be prescriptive. There's not one right way to do this, but there is a right way for the individual. And that's why tuning into what is that inner guidance that I might be avoiding or denying or distracting from can be really powerful and revealing.
Fantastic. Lovely talking to you, Lauren. Thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks so much again for having me on.
Special thanks to this week's guest, Lauren Farina. We'll be back with another new episode next week. In the meantime, if you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast, and we'd be pleased if you'd consider sharing the episode. To become an ISF member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.